and questions we've got here. And his motive to prove that the Earth is flat, wow. That's a character. That's quite a story, Roy. EC2GS, what journal did you read that in? KQLIW in the TechNet?
NWS2, and Evel Knievel didn't make that. He tried. He did try, but he didn't make it, Nick.
It wasn't a rocket failure. His parachute deployed too soon. That's what his failure was. The rocket was running like a charm, as I remember. Go ahead, Roy.
E2IS info.
You got it, Bill.
Okay, so what I've heard about this guy is that he has launched himself on a rocket before and somehow survived. I don't know what his method was for getting back to the ground without being pasted, but apparently this whole flat earth thing is something that he took up sort of as a convenience. Apparently it's easier to get crowdfunding from flat earth people than from people that assume that you're just going to kill yourself with your rocket. AC2IS.
Yeah, thank you for that, Bill. Roy, where did you read about this? And, unusual story, unusual guy. You got it right.
Yeah, it was in a whole bunch of websites. He's a publicity hound, and I was hoping that he just wanted publicity and wasn't planning to kill himself. And you would think that people didn't believe in the flat earth, but it's kind of interesting. Every so often when people have nothing better to do, they poll people and they ask them questions like, do you believe that the earth is flat or round? And there's always some percentage that thinks it's flat. They also poll people, you know, we had this question a couple of weeks ago about the sun being the center of the universe, the earth being the center of the universe. There are some polls that show 15-20% of the people asked think that the earth is the center of the universe. So go figure. But let me have it drop for a sec.
And there's also people believe that Apollo never went to the moon. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, unfortunately, that's quite true, but we have a witness in you. This gentleman, in addition to this, fortunately, everyone who heard this story ran over to land management, the Department of Land Management that manages this land, and said, what the hell, why did you let him do that? To which they said, do what? And so they put a kibosh on it. So they stopped it for, it was supposed to be yesterday, they stopped it. He says he's going to try and do it again next Saturday. His game plan down the road, which makes no sense to me, it sounds like a perpetual motion machine. He's going to elevate his steam rocket in a hot air balloon, I guess, some kind of balloon, and elevate it as high as humanly possible, and then activate the thrusters, and he thinks that's going to get him up to 80 miles above ground. So I don't know what he's smoking.
When it comes to a small, inexpensive rocket engine, he may be on the right track. When you take water and put it in a closed container that can tolerate very high pressure, and you superheat that water, so what comes back out of that nozzle is superheated steam, you get a lot of thrust per pound of propellant. So when it comes to efficiency of rocket engines, he's on the right track. Because the degree of complexity to make a liquid-fueled real rocket, so to speak, is probably 1,000 times more difficult than what he's doing. So he and Evel Knievel are on the right track on that point. And I'm having trouble believing that he really believes the Earth is flat. He's just claiming that he's a flat earther because that's where he's getting funding. That's a guess on my part, and I think that's what you just said, Roy. AC2GS, K2RAW.
I certainly hope so. I mean, the most troubling technological aspect of this all is a braking system. He's shot the rocket up. I don't know if it was manned or not. There was a camera in it because he has video of it. And it uses the most moth-eaten parachute I've ever seen as a means of getting back to the ground. But if he's going to try this miles and miles above the ground, he's going to need more than a hole-laden parachute to get him back down. But again, I get the idea that this is publicity, 99.9% of it. But it's interesting publicity. And the funny thing is, you know, people think that everyone thought the Earth was flat up until Columbus. But in fact, the Greeks not only knew it was round, but measured it to about a 10% tolerance 200 years B.C. Matter of fact, Christopher Columbus was well aware of that study, and he didn't believe it. He thought, actually, the Earth was about 30% smaller. So that way, he would be able to sail to the other side without running out of food and such. So people knew it was round, even back then.
What is the peak altitude this guy thinks he's going to get up to, Roy?
This initial test that was supposed to take place yesterday reported two different things. It reported 1,800 feet, and it reported 1 mile, which is 5,300 feet. The final experiment with the boost from the balloon is supposed to be 80 miles above the Earth.
But a balloon can get you to close to 100,000 feet. 100,000 feet is something like 20 miles. At 100,000 feet, you can start seeing Earth curvature, without a doubt. But the altitude he's going at right now, a mile, you're not going to see any of the curvature of the Earth at that time. So if he's claimed he's doing this to prove flat Earth, you got to be close to 100,000 feet to really see Earth curvature, I believe. Over to you, Roy.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I believe the Concorde went up 60,000 feet. They said they... the people on the Concorde could see the curvature of the Earth.
Glad to hear that. Go ahead, Roy.
If you look at a ship coming in on the shore, you could tell the curvature of the Earth. Again, it doesn't require rocket science. It really doesn't.
G2OIS.
Well, when you watch a ship go over the horizon, you get the secondary effect of Earth curvature. Your eye doesn't see the curvature per se. Mr. OIS, go right ahead. Give us your full call and name first.
Mark, KC2OIS. And as you know from before, I believe that the Earth may be flat. And they have done a test from the shoreline, watching the boats disappear. Then you go like 300 miles or 500 miles and get a lens and look out, and where you see that the boat is going by the curvature, and you look out at the boat with a lens, all of a sudden the boat reappears again. So no matter how far you look out, it's still going to be flat. It's not going to curve off. And what about the water? Isn't the water flat? Is that why they call it, don't they call that the horizon? What do they call this? I mean, you know, they call this is the curvature of the Earth? Or is this, well, what is it? You know what I'm saying? So, and these guys that go up and they send these rockets up with the balloons, let me let it drop a second.
I'm at 101YDY.
When these... guys go up and they send these balloons up, they're like, you know, balloons are like satellites, so, you know, they send the balloon up, and they already filmed the balloon hitting the firmament of the Earth. Talks about the firmament in the Bible, if you believe the Bible, and everybody else that doesn't believe in the flat Earth, well, they believe in Copernicus. So, you know, you have your choice of what you want to believe in. And, you know, some people believe in evolution, some believe in creation. So I don't believe in evolution. I don't believe in Darwin. I think he was a racist. And that's what I believe. Over to you, Dick.
C2IS coming.
Yeah, we're going to pick up Hank first before Bill. As Neil deGrasse Tyson often says, in this country, you're allowed to continue to believe anything you want to believe. And you probably know, Mac, Mark, that you have an opinion that's not the majority. Your opinion is a more minority opinion. NYDY, Hank, has spent a lot of hours of his life as a pilot in aircraft at some pretty high altitudes. I'll bet you've seen the Earth curvature, daytime, nighttime, sunrise, sunset, during eclipses. I bet you've seen a lot of Earth curvature over a lot of hours. That's a guess on my part, Hank. NYDY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
You pretty much nailed it on the head, Dick. Seen lunar eclipses from the airplane, never a solar, but I've been up at 60,000 feet and I've seen the curvature of the Earth. I've seen the sky black during the day. There's and I've lived on a boat, and I can tell you the difference between, independent of the quality or the power of your binoculars, the difference between the local horizon as a function of height. Just trying to pick up a person who might be overboard in the boat, you send somebody up the tuner tower so that you can see the person when you return to go pick them up if you don't have a GPS. So I'm not trying to argue with the gentleman, but I can only tell you that in my experience, everything points to the concept of the Earth being round and there existing a real curvature. And NYDY.
To the question then, so if you're a pilot and you're looking through, I don't know what kind of glass you're looking through, what the windshield is, or what the people on the plane are looking through, and what kind of, you're looking like through a fisheye or something like that, you know, that makes it look round, okay? If you're flying your plane and there's a curvature in the Earth, that means that you have to, every so many minutes or so many miles, or nautical miles or whatever you might call it up there, I don't know, you have to nose down the plane. Is that what you do?
And he does it for you, KD2FRU.
Atmosphere and gravity do it for you. You don't really nose the plane down because you don't have the thrust in order to continue to go straight. If I did, and I understand what you're trying to say, if I had more thrust, then we could have that conversation. But the fact is that an air-breathing jet engine simply doesn't have the ability to go off on the tangent to the Earth's surface. And so therefore, with the limited power available and the gravity and the thickness, or actually the density of the air, the aircraft remains at a relatively constant distance above the surface. And as the surface of the Earth falls off, the air plane continues to remain at a constant altitude relative to the surface, measured either in MSL or AGL, depending upon what instruments you're using. So if you're using a barometric gauge, it's going to be AGL, and MSL, which is mean sea level above some arbitrary amount of pressure.
Every satellite in orbit chooses a curved path. It has no choice. Mark, are you telling me that we don't have any satellites in orbit?
I'm not so sure about that either. Let me ask you another question, though. So when you're in South America, okay, and you want to go to Australia, why do the planes have to go north and then come back south? Why don't they just go across? And where is the GPS? Because there's no GPS going across over there.
There's GPS everywhere. And what you're discussing is the so-called great circle phenomenon. When you take a spherical globe that sits on many people's desk, and you take a piece of string between Australia and the United States, for instance, New York City and Australia, let's say Adelaide, and you draw the string tight, various portions of that path, you're not flying one simple compass reading. That's the so-called great circle, shortest possible path. I think Mark is telling us that there are no satellites in orbit and GPS doesn't exist. Mark, your opinion is such a minor opinion, it's kind of hard for the rest of the people listening to what you're saying to feel comfortable with that. Although Bill wants to make a comment on all of the above. AC2IS, K2RIW, LIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Somebody else pointed out, everybody, I guess, who has ever flown on Concorde has been able to look out the window and see the curvature of the Earth. If he's concerned about some distortion due to the glass on the windows of the Concorde, I've personally launched a weather balloon with a camera pointed out the side, no glass intervening other than the lens that comes with the camera. That camera captured images showing the curvature of the Earth. I could show him how to do that if he so chose, and he would have the evidence himself. Without any other person standing in between him and the evidence itself, and I believe that he will either decline the offer or, refuse any piece of evidence that anyone offers him. AC2IS.
Eric recognized up. Mark, I'm going to give you one more transmission, so to speak, to defend your point of view if you want to. Other than that, I'm going to cut you off on this level of conversation in that direction because it is so different from what the majority, I believe, think. AC2OIS with one more transmission. K2LIW, go ahead, Mark.
Hey, Roger, that. I agree. Whatever you want to do, that's fine. You're in control. First of all, let's take a look at the UN flag. The UN flag is flat. They're showing a flat Earth, the UN flag. Why do they call it the horizon? Why don't they call it the curvature? And how is the water curved? That's what I like to know. You tell me how the water is curved when the water lays flat.
One crazy question I've got for you, Mark. When you look at the moon or when you look at the sun with the right kind of instrument, are you looking at a round object or are you looking at a flat object from your point of view?
I think that the sun could be round. I'm not too sure about the moon. All I know is that I don't believe that the sun is reflecting off the moon, but there's no heat reflected off the moon with the light from the sun and the moon coming to Earth. And I believe that the moon has its own light.
Okay. I hear what you're saying. Who was the other person that wanted to say something?
Sorry.
You got it, Eric.
All right. This is a classic example of psychology, really, or socialization. Whereas as you grow up, okay, those things that you learn and believe become ingrained, the innate part of your being. For those that believe that there's some magic man somewhere that's invisible that nobody ever sees that created everyone's destiny, you want to go back in history and discover why people had these stories. You have this thing called the Bible, which is a book of stories that have been handed down. It's sort of semi-history, some of it semi-fiction, whatever it is that you want to believe. Once you become that part of you, it becomes innate. No matter how much you try to reason with someone about physics, gravity, I mean, here's your question about why there's a water curve. I mean, there's this concept called gravity. Just, you have to have the desire to really understand that. Well, look into that property. Because there's the physical world and there's the imaginary world. And many people live in the imaginary world, just as much as we say that moon is made out of green cheese. So you reach a certain point and you got to allow people to be who they are and what they think and what they believe and be okay with it. K2RIW, K2JX.
I heard a couple of syllables of a sound. Do you want to repeat that?
Yeah, it's Whiskey 2, Bravo Zoom. Hear me well, then I'll just forget it and I'll write.
Okay, you're dropping out probably because of overmodulation or a weak signal. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, blank. Speak softly and try to
little whip indoor, ask if it would be okay for me to comment on a subject that was covered about HDR and televisions and high def and all that.
Every fourth word is being dropped out, so I think you're going to have great trouble asking your question about high definition television. Try to put it as briefly as you can and give it an attempt, but you keep dropping out. I think you're on a handy talkie, and as you move the handy talkie, you're dropping in and dropping out. You may be victimized by the fact that when you're talking to a repeater, your transmit frequency and your receive frequency are slightly different. As such, when you move the handy talkie around so that when you're receiving you get the stronger signal, that may not be the best position for the stronger signal when you transmit. Make a quick attempt. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
375, he's on 375.
He's on 375. I'll listen there. So, make an attempt. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, K2LAW. Maybe he moved to a bad position. So, you've stirred us up a little bit tonight, Roy. And that guy who is launching that rocket, that he's going to, I think he's already put himself in it. But 1,800 feet, that's nowhere near high enough to do anything significant in the direction he claims he is moving. Do you think he has a long-range plan? I mean, after he settles the issue of Earth curvature, does he intend to do something with it, to your knowledge? AC2GS, K2LIW.
N1YDY.
Let's go to Roy first, and then we'll go back to Hank. Go ahead, Roy.
I kind of doubt it. I think he's a publicity hound, and he just wants to have his name published all over the world and be famous. I just want to say that this little conversation may be very nostalgic for the conversations that I used to have with John May, rest in peace, and Wesley in the middle of the night. And I want to just tell a very, very short story that Carl Sagan told. If I can, I'll let it drop for a second.
We like hearing John Carl Sagan stories. Go right ahead.
Okay, so the story went that Carl Sagan was giving his usual presentation to non-scientists about the cosmos. And he got applause, and the people shuffled out, and one mature lady walked up to him and told him, Professor Sagan, you're totally wrong about it. The Earth is completely flat. So Professor Sagan looked at her and said, okay, if it's flat, what's keeping it up? So the lady looked at him and said, it's a giant tortoise. It sits on a giant tortoise. So Professor Sagan said, but what's holding the tortoise up? And she looked at him and smiled and says, it's tortoises all the way down.
Wow. So, Sagan became very popular on the Johnny Carson show, among other places. And a large number of people listened to a Sagan presentation and were happy. A number of scientists were unhappy with Sagan because they thought he was grandstanding. Who cares? Even if he was grandstanding, even if his major motivation was a little bit less than honorable, the overall effect was he was teaching science to a hell of a lot of people that were not being very well exposed to it ahead of the time, and now they had more scientific knowledge after listening to him. So if you believe the end justifies the means, even if he was grandstanding, so what? I'm willing to tolerate that. AC2GS, K2LAW.
I agree. And by the way, V3JIW is one of those guys in Canada that I set up the stream for. He just wanted me to tell you hello for him. But that's the ongoing problem between practicing scientists, researchers, and popularists. A lot of times there's no love lost between those two groups because the people discovering the things think that the guys popularizing it get more fame. I mean, there's very few that do both. Carl Sagan did some. Stephen Hawking did a lot. But there's always been that kind of abrasion between the two groups.
Is there another Carl Sagan story you want to give us? One last one? Go right ahead, Roy.
Well, I mean, the only story that I always kind of get stuck in me is I'd love to know where the man's accent came from, because I know for a fact he was born in Bensonhurst, which is about 5 miles away from where I was born. And I know a lot of people in Bensonhurst, and I've never bumped into a single person from there who sounds anything like that. And I remember listening to him with Walter Cronkite in the 60s, and even he didn't sound like him. So I'm always wondering where that accent ever came from. I'll probably never find out.
E2FIU.
Could be a function of some of the places where he has stayed for a period of time. My wife was born in the south of the United States, spent a significant number of years in Michigan, so from time to time she has a southern accent, from time to time she has a Michigan accent. He must have traveled to some particular place that we have to find out about. The person who just signed in, go right ahead, K2LIW.
E2FIU, George. My belief is the education system is giving merits unwarranted. KD2FIU, clear.
And no matter how they do it, it's never going to make everybody happy. There's no ideal way to educate. There's flaws, there's advantages and disadvantages every single technique. In the case of you going through a school to become a physician, I'll bet you've seen some methods of education. I'll bet you've seen some opinions expressed by students as to what is the proper way to treat patients. I bet you've heard a lot of differences of opinion. That's a guess on my part, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, but that subject could take up about 1,500 different TechNets. But medicine tends to often fall into the Socratic method, where you sit around in small groups and you ask the youngsters questions that are appropriate for the condition, and you kind of force them to think it through and come up with a reasonable answer, and then you either redirect them or smack them in the head or if they say something completely ridiculous at you. But that's my favorite method, personally. The easiest approach is to just stand up in front of an audience and read from a book, which is where the term lecturer came from. In the medieval days, that's how lecturers worked. They got up, they read the stuff, they closed the book, they walked away.
You are with a comment on that.
Go ahead, Hank.
You know, that's the way they teach aviation ground schools, and that's the difference between a good instructor and a bad instructor. We all have to stand up in front of the class and sing and dance, but the good guy can open the page and then, without looking at it, talk to the class about what's on it and engage the class in what they really need to know about what's on that page and not. And the other question I had for you guys is, earlier I had made some comments talking about the flat earth, and I just wanted to know, did I get through? Because when I released the mic button, it seemed there was a different conversation going.
The complexity of preparing a lesson.
No, you definitely got through, Hank. I was listening on the input. Everything you said got through. And I'm not quite sure what the long delay was, but not to worry. We're going to... We better go over to the space report. I thank you, Roy. I'm sorry we put you so late tonight. We'll do better next week. We had this unusual group of people, an unusual group that gave us information.
Repeater, timeout.
Unusual people that we've never heard before, how that Don subway system really works. A system that runs at 600 volts at 5,000 amperes is an unusual chunk of electronics. That's got a power supply every couple of miles down the track. Wow. Let's see if we can squeeze in some at least me some of the headlines with reference to the space report, Paul. WS2N, K2RW, you got it, Paul.
Okay, maybe Boy wants to give out that email one more time, though, before people leave.
Yeah, Roy, give out the email, and also, I guess we don't really have to give out that email yet with reference to the Fluke equipment. We haven't gotten deep enough into that yet that people have to see that Fluke website yet, but that's your choice. But please repeat your website again, AC2GS, K2LIW.
Yes, sure. The email address is mailbag@limarktech.net. Again, mailbag@limarktech.net. Thank you.
That's a very easy one to remember. And so keep those cards and letters coming to Roy. And as you can tell, Roy will accept cards and letters on some pretty divergent subjects. He's willing to use divergent analysis. He's not narrow-minded. He's very broad-banded. So even the things that amateur radio operators might not be curious about, you're allowed to ask questions and send him mailbag on those questions. WS2M, tell us what NASA's been doing, and maybe even what Voyager is doing. I can't believe Voyager made that big a change in the last week, but you never know. You got us, Paul, K2LIW.
Okay, yeah, we covered Voyager before, but I guarantee we'll be talking about the end of Voyager at probably 10 or 15 years from now. As far as the SpaceNet report, we have the Virgin Orbit, they call it Virgin Orbit, you know, that's the same company, it's a spin-off company of Virgin Galactic, which is run by Richard Branson. This company is developing rockets that they're going to use to put satellites into space, a couple of hundred pound satellites. They'll be able to put it in any plane at any time that they want, any plane of, you know, any inclination, because they're going to have a carrier jet, and they're going to use a 747, one of his older 747s he converted into a jet that he'll be able to carry this rocket. The rocket's called Launcher 1, and that'll be attached to the bottom of the 747. He'll drop that, and it'll ignite and go into orbit, send a payload into orbit. It'll be a two-stage rocket, and it's you know, the idea is very similar to what Orbital ATK has been doing with the Pegasus rocket. The difference is Pegasus was taken up on a jumbo jet, also a Lockheed L-10-11, and that's still doing that, but they're only down to about a flight per year. This company, Virgin Orbit, will probably do maybe a half a dozen flights per year once they get going. The first flight should take place in the first couple of months of 2018, next year. So a few months from now, we'll be able to see how that goes. Another space mission to Mars is now on the drawing board. We'll launch in 2020, and this one will go out to the moons of Mars. It'll go out to Phobos and Deimos. And it's called the MMX, Mars Moon Exploration Mission, Martian Moon Exploration. So the MMX is going to be a mission that's done by JAXA, that's Japanese version of NASA. So JAXA is going to be doing that. But they want NASA to be on board with their equipment. We're going to supply that mission with a spectrometer, and European Space Agency, they're going to have their own contribution as well. So that will be launched in 2020 from Japan, and it'll not only go to the moons of Mars, it will land on one of them. They plan on landing on Phobos, picking up some rock or soil, whatever it might be, and returning it to Earth. So it'll be a first return mission from another moon besides our moon. Return time would probably be 2025. It'll launch from Earth in 2020, roughly a year, 6 to 8 months before it gets to Martian orbit, and then it'll deorbit Mars and come back in 2025. That's called the MMX. So, as that thing gets developed, I'll talk about that more. The James Webb Space Telescope. They picked out a couple of locations they plan on doing science when they get that telescope to the L2 position. It's the first time that scientists have actually got a choice, to pick out the first things that they're going to investigate, which involves, actually one of them involves looking at Jupiter. So I guess that's going to help calibrate things. Let me drop it. Now, the InSight mission, that's now planned for May of next year as well. So that's the interior exploration using seismic investigations, geodesy, and heat transport. So that will take off in May using an Atlas V rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. That will be the first interplanetary launch of an American rocket, besides using the launch complexes in Florida. This will take off from Vandenberg Air Force Base. So they're working on that. I was looking at one of the experiments that they're going to have on board. It's called the HP3. When InSight lands, it's not going to have wheels. It's not going to be a rover. But it does have an arm. It's going to use the arm to pick up an experiment called the HP3. HP is for heat probe 3. And they're going to have this 7-foot arm extend and put it on the ground. And it's going to have a tether that's going to be connected to the InSight lander. Now, this gadget that they're going to put on the surface of Mars, the HP3, is going to self-drill and hammer itself into the ground. And as it goes down, it's got this tether with wires connected to this probe that's going to be digging itself into the ground. It's got a nice feeding system. I've seen the feeding system. It's not a coil, but it's going to unfurl. It's got this triangular base, where this tether is going to go down and follow this thing into the ground. I remember telling John KC2WGB about this thing a couple of years ago when it was supposed to be first launched. But it was delayed because they had a problem with one of the experiments, seismometer that was not working. They had to work on that, and that delayed the mission for 2 years. But this thing is going to hammer itself 15 feet into the ground. That I want to see because I haven't figured out how, if they hit a rock or something, they're going to be dead in the water. But if it goes off center as it's going down, it won't matter too much because it's going to be hammering itself into the ground and pulling this tether behind it. So, but I mean, if it is something hard, they're not going to be able to do it. They said that they're going to know the land area pretty good from the high-rise camera on one of the orbital satellites. Probably use the MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, that has a good camera, it's called the high-rise camera, and they'll have a good idea of where they're going to land this thing. So, that should be interesting. The InSight mission was supposed to be 2 years ago. One of the experiments was not working. It was being built by Kinesis, which is the
French version of NASA, and they were building it, and they couldn't get this thing to stop leaking. They gave up, delayed the mission for 2 years, let JPL take over, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and they handled this whole problem that the French couldn't do, and they got a good deal on this piece of equipment, and now they're ready. They'll be able to launch on time, hopefully in May. And that's pretty much it, Dick. We'll turn it back to Nat. Any questions, comments? There's always more things, but we'll wait until next week. This is WS2S.
Yeah, before I proceed, is there anyone that wants to ask a poll any questions on what you've heard or what you haven't heard, what you'd like to hear about space? If anybody has a question for Paul, please give me a call, letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, there being none, I'll put in a couple of comments of mine. When it comes to analyzing what's inside of the tail of a comet, to send a spacecraft out there to gather some of that material and bring it back to Earth, that makes some sense. And then analyze it if you can get it back safely without damaging it on the way. But if you want to know what's going on above or below the surface of Mars, for instance, if you're smart enough, this is an opinion, if you're smart enough and you devise the right kind of instrumentation, whatever measurement you want to make, spectroscopy, temperature characteristics, and so on, reaction to chemistry, you can devise a spacecraft that can go there and make the measurement for you and send the information back as a radio signal. To think that you've got to return the mission, to return the material for analysis in your own favorite laboratory on Earth, is conventional thinking, and I'm not convinced that it's the right way to do it. To gather a sample and bring it all the way back home from something as far away as Mars, essentially the nearest local planet, but it's 1,000 times further away than the moon. And look what it took to get a human being on the moon. To fly to Mars and take a sample and bring it back home, that's a big deal. To go and make the measurement there, I think, is a lot more efficient. With one exception.
Repeater, timeout.
With one exception. If the sample that you're about to measure has to be subjected to something very unusual, like the output energy of the Large Hadron Collider, the 27-kilometer thing that is below the surface of France and Switzerland, that machine is so big, you don't want to build a miniature version of it and send it to Mars. So in that case, if you've got to subject your sample to the beam coming out of the LHC, then yes, you've got to bring the sample back home. But short of something as elaborate as that, I think you're much better off to make a good machine that makes the measurement in situ and then mails back the data on a radio beam. I'm a little bit amazed that more people haven't come to that opinion. So, of the missions you know of, Paul, where they're going to take a sample and bring it all the way back home, is there something so elaborate of the test they want to do on the sample that it can only be done on planet Earth? WS2N, K2RIW, over to you, Paul.
Well, I guess it has to do with sending the equipment similar to what's on Curiosity. Curiosity has its own test equipment on board. And so does the new 2020 rover that's going to go to Mars in 2020. Kind of looks like Curiosity. They have these, inside the body of the rovers, they take this material from the ground and they analyze it, and they do a lot of things that you probably could do also on Earth. But from what I heard from the geologists, they would do more tests if they could get some stuff home. Now, in the case of Phobos, one of the moons around Mars, this MMX flight will go in orbit and then go close to Phobos and eventually land on Phobos. That's a very relatively small small spacecraft, not as big as Curiosity, and very little gravity in it. It'll probably just barely hang on to the moon when they land there, and then they'll probably just scoop some stuff up, get it caught up inside the return mechanism, and then launch that back to Earth orbit, and do it that way. It's been done with Comet. You had the Stardust mission many years ago that went out to Vilt. They called it Vilt Comet, Vilt, W-I-L-T, the Vilt 2 Comet. And I took samples from the tail of that comet and brought it back to Earth. And they landed it in the Utah desert, and that was very successful. It's probably something similar. You're not going to send this science lab all the way to Phobos. The cost would be phenomenal to do that. So now this is Japan's idea. They want to bring it back, and we'll see what happens. Russia tried to do it many years ago, about 10, 12 years ago, and it failed. It was the Phobos mission. And you can look at, there's another one up. You can look up, I think it was called the Grunt mission. And it went into Earth orbit and then didn't have enough velocity and wound up coming back and never left Earth orbit. It wound up in the ocean. So that was supposed to be a sample return mission as well, but that didn't work out. That was by Russia. We've never tried it. We are going to do something similar to that on the Curiosity version of the next one that looks like Curiosity 2020 mission. That rover is going to land on Mars and pick up samples and attach it to itself. They look like 20 of these test tube things in different locations. They'll drill into the ground, into the rocks. It's like a little core borer. It's going to take out core borer samples instead of just powder. That's what Curiosity does. These will be core boring samples, and they're going to put it into the rover, and then someday in the future, one of the rockets will go there, meet up with that 2020 rover, take those samples, put it into the return vehicle. It'll launch off the surface of Mars and bring it home. That's a long-term plan, but they have a sample return mission plan for the 2020 Mars rover. Back to you, Derek.
The Curiosity-like device that's a little bit larger and a little bit more elaborate and going to be doing some drilling and whatever, that's going to go to Mars in 2020, I'm kind of forgetful. Does that mission yet have a name, or is it just called the 2020 Mars mission like Curiosity? Over to you, Paul.
Like a lot of these missions, they'll eventually name it. They'll probably get school children to write in, I think that's how they got Curiosity's name. But right now, it's the 2020 rover mission.
And the major difference from Curiosity has two or three of the radioactive thermal generators on board. The plutonium required for those, I think, is in short supply. So the 2020 mission, I'm having trouble believing they can put on a big enough solar panel, that it can collect sunlight to run it. So is there a commitment for its power generation that's going to do all these elaborate things? How much bigger? How much higher in capability? You've told us once before, but please tell me once again, what's currently planned for power and increased capability of the 2020 rover mission? Love you, Paul. K2RIW.
That won't be the same as Curiosity sticking out of the back. It looks like a tail sticking up in the back of Curiosity. Same setup, one RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, and that will be running it. So, it's not solar panel. Two previous rovers, Opportunity and Spirit, they were solar panels, and of course Opportunity is still running it, since 2004. Here it is all these years later, and that, that one is still going. But this phone will have the RTG as well, and it's already, done. That will be that will definitely be on that rover.
Okay, and if I'm comparing the current Curiosity to the 2020 rover, what's the easiest way to know what is the increase in capability of the 2020 rover? It has some drilling capability. It's going to be taking samples that are put into test tubes, ready to be returned to the Earth on some later mission. Does it have more elaborate cameras, more elaborate analysis tools? What does it have that Curiosity doesn't have? And I presume this is a reasonably expensive spacecraft, is my guess, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, it started off as $2.5 billion. Now it's, I think, $3 billion. It's got 23 cameras instead of 17 cameras that Curiosity had. Better drilling equipment, more elaborate testing equipment on board. You know, it uses its arm, puts stuff into the body of the rover, and that rover has all the test equipment inside. In fact, this time it's got a camera inside. You'll be able to see the sample being tested. So it's got video capability, all kinds of stuff. And I've run out of time. We've run out of time. Back to you, Dick, WS2M for the SpaceNet report.
Does it have a microphone? I'd certainly like to listen to the wind on Mars. Back to you on that one, Paul.
It was supposed to have to check. I don't know if it's going to have it. I think it's got it on the body of the rover as it comes down. It'll be able to hear things happening as it's coming down. That was the plan for the Phoenix mission. The Phoenix mission was very successful. That was not a rover, but that was successful. Landed, but the microphone didn't work.
Yeah, can you imagine if a Martian started talking to them? You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1678. You just heard Space Report number 278. We'll be back next week if all goes well. And we're going to give Roy a little bit more time next. We're not going to delay Roy so much next week. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. Be kind to each other. Roy, you want to say anything final to these guys? And before we leave, AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yeah, sure. This is AC2GS, and the mailbag, once again, is mailbag@limarktech.net. Or you can look me up on QRZ. Find me all over the place. Just throw questions at me, please.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.